Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we are doing a deep dive into the American County Sheriff. Now, this is an office you probably see as, you know, standard local law enforcement.
Right, just the top in the county.
Exactly. But the comprehensive legal analysis we've been studying argues something much, much bigger. It argues that the sheriff is the single most constitutionally protected and critical executive position in the entire country.
What's fascinating here is that we're looking so far beyond, you know, contemporary politics or the usual budget disputes.
This isn't about that.
Not at all. We are examining this sweeping legal framework. It draws really heavily from common law, colonial charters, early state Supreme Court decisions, and it posits that the sheriff's authority is, well, absolute within the county.
Absolute.
Yes, and that it cannot, under the Constitution, be diminished by state legislatures or even by governors.
That immediately raises the stakes, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Our sources don't treat this like a policy argument. They define it as a conflict over sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the core claim is that the sheriff is meant to be the people's bulwark against tyranny and the highest executive authority in the county, armored by both state and federal constitutions.
Precisely. And to understand that armor, we have to grasp the source's central concept, which they call the firewall.
The firewall.
It's a really detailed legal blueprint that defines this unbreachable hierarchy of law. So the mission for us today is to trace that hierarchy, understand the common law origins of the sheriff, and then analyze the specific ways, the sources actually call them usurpations, that this ancient office has allegedly been stripped of its essential powers in the modern era.
So we're not just exploring history here. We are navigating a legal thesis that outlines a very specific, immediate, and peaceful path for restoring the sheriff's original, unalterable common law authority.
That's the claim.
Let's jump straight into the foundation of that authority then. The immutable principles and this firewall itself. To really get a handle on the sheriff's constitutional shield, we first have to accept this absolute, really rigid hierarchy of law that our source material insists governs all legitimate authority. This is the foundation of the firewall.
It really is. And it starts right at the very top. Tier one, the law of nature is supreme.
Okay, that sounds pretty philosophical.
It is, but it's also foundational to Anglo-American jurisprudence. I mean, it asserts that there is a law coeval with mankind and dictated by God that is superior to any statute, any political declaration, or any human decree.
We are talking about ideas that predate our country by centuries. This is almost pre-Socratic stuff, not just legal code.
Absolutely. The source pulls heavily from figures like William Blackstone, who famously declared that the law of nature is superior in obligation to any other.
So what does that mean in practice?
It means if a statute violates this superior law, the law, you know, written on the hearts of men, if you will, then that statute is void ab initio.
Void from the beginning.
It never had the force of law. The sources argue that true law follows this unbreakable four-tier structure. First nature, then fundamental maxim.
Like what kind of maxims?
Like the principle that no one may be a judge in their own cause. Just basic, unshakable truths of justice.
Okay.
Then you have constitutions, which merely define the powers government does have. And then at the very bottom, you have enactments, statutes, and codes.
Mm.
And they are always, always subordinate to the tiers above.
That established, the firewall then moves to tier two, which defines where power actually comes from. Our sources insist all rights are pre-political.
And this is such a critical philosophical distinction, and it has massive legal implications.
That's so.
Rights are not granted by the state. They're God-given. They're unalienable. They exist before government is even created.
So government's job isn't to create rights.
No, its only job is to secure and protect them. The source cites an early Supreme Court case, Van Horn v. Dorrance, which established that individual liberties are antecedent to all government.
Antecedent. I like that word.
It's powerful, right? It means rights are declared, not granted, and they can't be touched, they can't be diminished, they can't be suspended by a mere statute, not even if there is a claim of emergency. If the government tries to diminish a right, it is, by definition, operating outside its legitimate mandate.
And that idea of a mandate leads right into Tier 3, which is surprisingly restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
The sole end of government.
It really is.
It exists to protect life, liberty, and property.
Uh-huh.
And that's it. Nothing else.
This is where the firewall puts government into its tightest cage. It draws from John Locke's second treatise, where the source argues that government is only legitimate when it is exclusively securing those three unalienable rights.
So any other function?
Any other function. Social engineering, wealth redistribution, or, and this is critical, revenue generation through enforcement is deemed usurpation and oppression.
So wait, if a state legislature passes a law that taxes citizens to fund something outside the direct protection of life, liberty, and property, the source material defines that as illegitimate.
That is the uncompromising position, yes. And that philosophical limitation is then reinforced by Tier 4, which is the strict rule of delegated authority only.
It sounds like the practical lock on the cage.
Precisely. Government, whether it's state or county, derives its sole power from the explicit, expressed delegation of the people through the Constitution. If the people didn't explicitly grant the power, if it's not written down, the government doesn't have it.
And there are rules that govern that grant of power.
Five iron rules, they call them. Two are paramount. One, power not expressly granted has no authority. That's from Black's Law Dictionary. And two, delegated power cannot be redelegated.
Okay, hold on. Let's unpack that redelegation rule, because that seems to have huge implications for the modern administrative state.
It does, a huge one. The principle delegata potestas non potest delegari means that the legislature, which got its power from the people, cannot just hand off its lawmaking or regulatory power to someone else.
Like an unelected agency.
Or a private corporation, like a state bar association, or even a federal department. The moment they attempt to do that, that transfer is void. The source calls any power exercised beyond this explicit grant usurpation, pure treason against the people's sovereignty.
Pure treason. That is extremely strong legal language. What allows the sources to use such uncompromising terms?
The strength of the language is tied directly to the violation of the people's trust.
The social contract.
If the government violates the written contract, the Constitution, by exercising power it wasn't given, or by giving its power away, it is fundamentally betraying the sovereignty of the people who granted that power in the first place.
Which connects to Tier 5, oaths bind absolutely.
Yeah, the moment of betrayal is the breach of the oath. Public officials swear an oath to uphold the constitutions. The source argues that if they breach that oath through maladministration, usurpation, or betrayal, the office is instantly forfeited.
Instantly, without a trial or impeachment.
That's the argument. The common law perspective cited by the jurist St. George Tucker asserts that authority vanishes the very moment the oath is broken. The act contrary to the oath is the betrayal, the rebellion against the people's trust, and their authority simply dissolves. It's self-executing.
That concept, self-execution, is profound. But let's step down the hierarchy a bit and look at Tier 7, the power of juries. If the oath is the first defense against betrayal, then the jury is the mechanism for the people to check the system directly.
Correct. And this power to indict with grand juries and to convict with petit juries, it resides solely with the people. It has to be free from control by judges or officials. The source really emphasizes this. The founders, you know, having just thrown off the yoke of the king, were adamant about the jury as the ultimate check. They cite John Adams, who in 1779 called the grand jury a check upon the government itself.
And the source even reaches into the 21st century to reinforce this, citing the Supreme Court.
They do. They cite Justice Scalia in the 2004 case, Blakely v. Washington, who referred to the jury as a fourth branch of government.
A fourth branch.
This placement outside the executive, legislative, and judicial spheres, it establishes the juror as the people's direct, non-governmental veto over the entire criminal justice process. If the sheriff is the chief executive, the grand jury is the chief investigator and accuser, and the petit jury is the final decider of guilt.
Okay, finally, let's look at Tier 10, which seems to pull a lot of these threads together. Self-executing forfeiture. This is the ultimate enforcement mechanism of the firewall.
This is perhaps the most radical claim of all. When officers breach the firewall, their office is dissolved instantly.
How do they justify that?
They use John Locke's Second Treatise, which posits that true rebellion is not committed by the citizens rising up, but by public officers who violate their trust and break the constitutional contract.
And how do they connect that ancient philosophy to modern constitutional law?
They connect it directly to the 14th Amendment, Section 3.
The disqualification clause.
Exactly. That clause disqualifies those who engage in insurrection or rebellion against the U.S. The source argues that oath-breaking is precisely that act of rebellion against the constitutional trust. And crucially, they argue this clause is self-executing.
So no formal declaration needed.
No legislation, no court process to effectuate the forfeiture. The violation is the conviction.
So to synthesize this deeply rigid framework, The firewall says power flows only from God and the people, and it's constrained entirely by constitutional terms.
Mm.
If government steps outside that narrow box by creating new powers, redelegating them, or enforcing unconstitutional statutes, they instantly lose all authority.
That is the core legal theory.
Right.
And now that we have established the cage, we can finally assess the sheriff, who the sources argue is the only officer who is both contained by the firewall and, at the same time, structurally protected by it.
Okay, so now we transition from that abstract constitutional theory to the specific office of the sheriff. And here's where it gets really interesting, because the source material makes a historical claim that is, well, it's startling to a modern American ear. The sheriff is not a creature of statute.
That is the defining characteristic.
Yeah.
It's what separates the sheriff from, say, the police chief or the state trooper. The sheriff, or the surgareffa, the shire reeve, is the oldest secular office in the entire Anglo-American legal tradition.
When you say oldest, what are we talking about chronologically? I mean, how far back?
We are talking pre-Norman conquest, so before 1066.
Wow.
The office predates Magna Carta, it predates the English Parliament, and it was certainly not created by a king. This is an ancient organic office of the people of the county, or the shire.
And what was the political significance of that origin? Why does that matter so much?
Well, the source notes that the sheriff was historically elected by the freeholders of the shire, and critically, he was viewed not as the king's agent, but as the county's man against the king when necessary.
So a check on centralized power, right from the beginning.
Exactly. The sheriff was the local representation of the common law itself, acting as the counterbalance to the power of the crown. The sources quote historian William Alfred Morris, who stated, "With the single exception of kingship, no secular dignity now known to English-speaking people is older." That level of historical precedence confers a massive independent authority.
And that antiquity didn't just stay in England, though. It crossed the Atlantic with the colonists.
It did, almost immediately. The sources point out that the office was established in colonial Virginia as early as 1634 with a man named William Stone in Accomack County.
Okay.
But then, after the American Revolution, the states did something revolutionary themselves. They took this independent common law office and they constitutionalized it eo nomine, by name. They wrote it into their organic law.
By simply writing the word sheriff into the state constitution.
Yeah.
What was the permanent legal consequence of that act?
Well, the legal consequence, according to this analysis, was twofold and permanent. First, by naming it, they permanently recognized its known common law character with all the powers that were attached to that history.
And second?
Second, they forever deprived the legislature of the power to materially cripple his core functions without a constitutional amendment. This is the constitutional armor plate we were talking about. It shields the office from the whims of ordinary legislative sessions.
Which brings us to the definitive legal doctrine that acts as the sheriff's primary defense against this kind of meddling, the Aller-Murphy rule.
This is the controlling doctrine for the entire discussion. It was adopted verbatim in a case called Aller v. Board of Auditors in Michigan in 1880, but the principle itself is rooted in earlier common law.
What does the rule say?
It states that when the office of sheriff is constitutional, the sheriff ex officio by the force of the term itself must possess all substantial common law powers historically attached to that office.
So the legislature can tinker around the edges, but they can't break the core machine.
Exactly. The legislature can add new administrative duties, you know, managing computer systems or administering new permits, provided those duties aren't unconstitutional themselves.
Right.
But what the legislature cannot do is strip him of his time-honored and common law functions and devolve them upon the incumbents of other offices created by legislative authority.
So that's the anti-diminution principle.
That's it. If the legislature tries to transfer a core common law power-like prosecution or jail management to a new legislatively created office, that transfer is void. The original power remains with the sheriff.
The sources suggest this isn't just a Michigan anomaly. They argue it's a national consensus.
They do. They list examples from all over the country to demonstrate the strength of this legal shield. You see, Alabama rulings confirming duties cannot be diminished. Florida rulings stating the legislature may not abolish or diminish core functions.
Mm-hmm.
And Wisconsin rulings affirming that the sheriff retains his ancient character and is accountable only to the voters. The consistent finding is that the sheriff is the independent constitutional executive of the county, accountable only to the electorate, with no superior within the county's jurisdiction.
So if the legislature cannot diminish the office, What exactly are those core irreducible powers that the Constitution perpetually protects?
The sources distill them into six non-negotiable common law powers. These are what define the common law sheriff.
Okay, let's listen.
Number one, to keep the peace of the county. This is the primary executive mandate. It supersedes all others.
Right.
Two, the power to arrest. But this is strictly limited, without a warrant, only upon an actual breach of the peace committed in his presence or upon reasonable grounds to believe a felony has been committed.
Very specific.
Very. Three, to summon the posse comitatus and the grand jury. And let's pause on posse comitatus for a second. That's the power of the county.
The right to call on citizens for help.
It's the sheriff's right to command the assistance of any able-bodied person in the county to help enforce the law. This power is the direct expression of the people's sovereignty, and it's vested in the sheriff.
Okay, what's next?
Four, to execute all lawful process. And the key word there is lawful. The sheriff has to vet every order against the Constitution and the firewall.
He's not just a delivery service for the courts.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Five, to take charge of the county jail, a fundamental executive duty tied to the physical liberty of the citizens. And six, and this is maybe the most critical one that's been lost, to serve as the county's public prosecutor when no other officer is provided.
So the Allen Murphy rule means that the moment the state constitution named the sheriff, that specific job description, those six common law powers, was set in granite, protected by the firewall against any legislative tampering.
Exactly. And the source argues that the constitutional clock is always running back to that baseline, which was defined by common law texts like Anderson on the Sheriff from 1849. Any modern practice that violates one of those six core powers is, by legal necessity, unconstitutional.
Okay, so we've established the constitutional baseline and this unbreachable armor. Now let's pivot to the modern reality. The source material argues that this armored office has been systematically and quietly stripped of its power through eight categories of what they call usurpation.
Right, actions that effectively violate the Aller-Murphy rule.
Let's begin with the first one, the stripping of prosecutorial power. You said this was arguably the first and most damaging usurpation.
It is. Historically, the sheriff wasn't just the investigator and the jailer. He was the public prosecutor of the county. He investigated the crime, he summoned the grand jury, and he presented the evidence to them.
So that makes a sheriff uniquely accountable to the public, right? If he charged too many people or too few, the voters knew exactly who to hold responsible.
Correct. But starting in the mid to late 19th century, legislatures created the district attorney, or the DA, or the state's attorney, and they systematically transferred that prosecutorial function.
Which the source argues is a direct, fatal violation of Aller-Murphy.
It is. You cannot devolve a core constitutional function onto an office, the DA, that was created by mere statute. It's a direct contradiction.
And if that power transfer is void, then the creation of the district attorney's office results in the de facto abolition of the constitutional office of sheriff, even if the sheriff's name is still on the ballot.
That is the source's uncompromising conclusion. They argue that the power remains with the sheriff, dormant, but it was never lawfully removed. They even claim the legislative motivation was suspect, citing historical debates where the goal was admittedly to centralize prosecutions and remove that direct check from the people.
Turning prosecution into an arm of state policy.
Exactly, which violates Firewall Tier 3, the government's sole legitimate purpose.
The source material provided the Alabama Code as a case study. How does that single statute begin to strip away this prosecutorial power?
The Alabama statute specifically mandates the sheriff to ferret out crime and then turn the evidence over to the district attorney for prosecution.
So it makes him subordinate.
By making the sheriff subordinate to the DA for the filing of charges, it reduces the constitutional executive to a mere investigative agent for a statutory office. It is the clearest possible violation of the Aller-Murphy prohibition against devolving a core function to a legislatively created position.
Let's move to the second usurpation, revenue-driven policing and civil asset forfeiture. The source even calls it road piracy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is where the focus shifts from keeping the peace to generating income.
Right. The common law sheriff was funded by the county, not by penalties he levied on the public. Today, the office is often transformed into a profit center. Deputies are out there enforcing non-victim regulatory offenses, minor speeding, expired tags, and the source argues that these stops, which are initiated without an actual breach of the peace, are unlawful trespasses ab initio.
And what about civil asset forfeiture, or CAF? How does that violate the firewall?
CAF is presented as the ultimate perversion of the office. Because property is seized on suspicion alone, often without a criminal conviction, and the proceeds flow directly back to the seizing agency.
Which is often the sheriff's department.
Exactly. So this transforms the sheriff into the accuser, the judge, and the beneficiary all at once. It violates that ancient maxim. No one can be a judge in his own cause.
Do they have any data on this?
They cite some staggering numbers. Florida sheriffs, for example, extracted $358 million in a single fiscal year, 2023-2024, under their Contraband Forfeiture Act.
$358 million. That magnitude of revenue generation tied directly to law enforcement, it fundamentally changes the common law character of the sheriff.
Absolutely. The source argues it violates Magna Carta Section 40. To no one will we sell, to no one will we refuse or delay right or justice. When justice is monetized, it's being sold. And the sheriff ceases to be the custos pacis, the keeper of the peace, and he becomes a revenue officer, an unconstitutional diminution.
Let's move on to number 4 in the list of usurpations, bar association capture. This is one of the most specific and controversial claims. It argues that mandatory bar membership for the elected sheriff in states like Alabama, Florida, and Wyoming is an audacious usurpation.
This is framed as a fundamental corruption of the office's independence. The requirement that an elected constitutional officer must maintain membership in a private self-regulating corporation, the state bar, is argued to be unconstitutional for 3 fatal reasons.
Okay, reason 1, an unconstitutional additional qualification.
Right. The Constitution sets the qualifications for the office age, residency. The legislature is powerless to add new qualifications, like holding a bar card, without a constitutional amendment.
So adding a qualification by statute is just void.
It's seen as voiding the people's constitutional definition of the office. And this links back to Firewall Tier 4. The source also argues the bar's licensing authority itself is an illegitimate, redelegated power from the legislature.
Okay, reason 2. An incurable conflict of allegiance. This seems to connect directly to the binding power of the oath we talked about.
It does. The sheriff's constitutional oath is to the people and the Constitution. But the bar oath requires fidelity to its internal codes, imposing what they call a primary loyalty to the court and the profession.
So it creates two masters.
The source calls it perjury by design. A bar-admitted officer of the court is fundamentally compromised, serving 2 conflicting masters. The people's executive, and a private guild whose rules mandate subordination to institutional interests and the judiciary.
And reason 3, structural capture by monopoly. This is the financial dimension.
Yeah. The Bar Association relies on mandatory membership fees and, critically, court fees and litigation expansion for its financial survival. The sheriff, through arrest and prosecution, facilitates the revenue streams of the justice system.
So the sheriff becomes a cog in a machine that feeds the Bar Association.
The source argues it destroys the sheriff's independence and violates the guarantee that justice should be obtained freely. The constitutional sheriff must be financially independent of the system he is meant to check.
That is a fundamental challenge to the integrity of the entire justice system in those states. Let's look at the next one. Routine false arrest and false imprisonment, returning to the sheriff's core power to arrest.
At common law, the power to arrest without a warrant was incredibly narrow. It was limited to an actual breach of the peace committed in the officer's presence or reasonable grounds of a felony.
Right.
And the source emphasizes, citing Blackstone and Anderson on the sheriff, that regulatory infractions, expired registration, a suspended license, were never considered breaches of the peace.
But those minor offenses are the basis of millions of traffic stops every year.
Which means, according to this analysis, that every modern traffic start initiated solely for a nonviolent regulatory offense is false imprisonment at common law and an unlawful trespass ab initio.
Void from the moment it began.
Yes. They contend that the entire practice of investigatory detention, which was established in Terry v. Ohio in 1968, is a 20th century innovation with no root in the common law. It's an unconstitutional expansion of power beyond the sheriff's irreducible common law boundary defined by Aller Murfree.
And this systemic false imprisonment is made routine because of the next point, qualified immunity and indemnification.
At common law, personal liability was the only true restraint on abuse of power. If the sheriff or his deputy committed a trespass, an unlawful arrest, they were personally liable and paid the damages out of their own purse. There was zero immunity.
But that personal restraint has been systematically removed by 2 modern legal fictions, right?
Exactly. First, qualified immunity, or QI, which the source labels a judicial usurpation.
We like judicial.
Because it was created by courts. The Supreme Court has admitted QI has no historical foundation at common law. its creation violates Firewall Tier 8. The judiciary is supposed to declare law, not create new immunities that undermine ancient common law principles. QI effectively grants law officers a shield that allows them to claim ignorance of the very law they swore to uphold, which violates the maxim ignorantia juris non excusit. Ignorance of the law is no excuse.
And second, statutory indemnification, where the county or the state pays the judgment instead of the officer.
This completely destroys the personal risk and the deterrent effect. The source argues that these two doctrines are unconstitutional additions and subtractions to the office of the sheriff, making him the commander of an army that can violate rights with impunity because the officer risks nothing personally.
And the Alabama Code example reinforces this.
It does. It explicitly extends the statutory immunity to deputies, reinforcing this unconstitutional subtraction of personal liability.
This detailed analysis of usurpation brings us to the path to restoration. We start with this idea of the myth of the constitutional sheriff, a phrase that seems like a self-inflicted wound.
The source argues that the very necessity of the phrase is proof that the office has been functionally abolished.
How so?
Well, if the common law powers were still recognized, no one would need to use that phrase. Constitutional fidelity would just be the default setting. The source notes that only a tiny fraction of the more than 3,000 elected sheriffs nationally identify with groups that use this label.
So the use of the label itself proves the rule of usurpation. They've retained the name, but destroyed the powers.
It's evidence of the legislative subterfuge that was condemned in the Aller case. The default operation of most sheriff's offices today, focused on revenue, subordinate to state attorneys, protected by immunity, is operating under a diminished, unconstitutional conception of the office.
And the system relies entirely on the sheriff forgetting his own constitutional armor.
That's the argument.
So the mechanism for correcting this is the sheriff's lawful power and duty to refuse unlawful process, which we touched on. But practically, how does a sheriff go from being a functional administrator to a constitutional executive, you know, overnight?
It requires unilateral executive action. Without asking permission from the same systems, the legislature or the judiciary, that facilitated the usurpation in the first place.
Okay.
The source provides 8 steps for immediate restoration, emphasizing that they are all within the sheriff's existing unalienable constitutional powers.
Let's walk through those steps, starting with financial independence.
Step 1, refuse unfunded duties. The sheriff issues an order demanding proof of a specific line item appropriation for every new non-common law duty imposed by the legislature.
And if it's unfunded?
If the duty is unfunded or requires revenue generation through enforcement, the sheriff lawfully declines it as ultra vires beyond the legislature's delegated powers. This restores Firewall Tier 3, the sole end of government.
Second, reclaiming the ability to check the DA.
Step 2, resume a grand jury presentment. The sheriff issues an order bypassing the district attorney entirely. He summons the grand jury and presents evidence directly to them, reclaiming that ancient prosecutorial power that was never lawfully removed under Aller Murphree.
Reinstating the people's direct check.
And Firewall Tier 7, yes.
Third, cutting the federal strings immediately.
Step 3, end federal subordination. Issue a standing order. Refuse all federal grants with strings attached and return all 133 military equipment. The sheriff declares independence, answering only to the voters, not to Washington's policy priorities.
Fourth, addressing the daily practice of traffic enforcement, which the source calls false imprisonment.
Step 4, end routine traffic enforcement. The sheriff issues a standing order to deputies to cease all detention for nonviolent regulatory infractions unless an actual breach of the peace or a felony is suspected. This reverses the daily, systemic violation of common law arrest powers.
Fifth, directly confronting the bar capture in the 9 affected states.
Step 5, challenge bar capture. The sheriff files a declaratory action immediately against mandatory bar membership as an unconstitutional additional qualification. The sheriff, acting as the plaintiff, demands a judicial affirmation of the constitutional limits against the private guild.
Sixth, restoring accountability by removing immunity. How do they do that?
Step 6, strip immunity in practice. The sheriff adopts a policy stating the office will no longer assert qualified immunity in civil rights cases outside the narrow common law scope. This makes deputies answer with their own property.
Restoring personal liability.
The original constitutional check on abuse of power.
And finally, the most sweeping move, integrating parallel police forces.
Step 7, restoration of hierarchy. This is a unilateral executive order integrating all parallel law enforcement officers, municipal PDs, state task force members, you name it, into the sheriff's department under the direct command of the elected sheriff.
So the chief of police becomes a chief deputy.
Essentially, yes. The source argues this is necessary because the sheriff is the only elected constitutional peace officer in the county, and the Aller-Murfree rule demands the exclusive core power to keep the peace resides with him.
The source's argument is essentially that the modern system is fragile, that it's built on centuries of legislative neglect and administrative assumption.
Right.
And all it takes is one elected executive officer to remind the system of its own constitutional constraints.
If one sheriff takes these steps, the legislature is immediately forced to confront the constitutional crisis it created by violating the Aller-Murfree rule. The constitutional office has never been lawfully abolished. It has only been buried by statute.
This raises an important question, then. The source's argument is that the question of who truly holds the ultimate local sovereignty, is it the appointed bureaucrat or the elected sheriff, is still unresolved in practice.
That's the crux of it.
We've seen the legal character of the sheriff defined as irrevocable.
And if that common law character truly is irrevocable, then the moral and legal duty of the citizenry is to recognize the power they have vested in that office. The people's sheriff never ceased to exist. He has only been waiting for the officer and the electorate to reassert that ancient, powerful bond.
So the entire framework encourages you, the listener, to consider the structure of your own local law enforcement in light of these historical and legal claims.
And to understand that the defense of the firewall begins and ends with that single ancient office